Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
The human spirit and human desire and the problems that we have as a result of it cannot be quenched or pacified forever by this algorithmic mimicry and by this cheap pleasure. Our spirit longs for an encounter. It wants a true other. It wants a vulnerable other. It wants God and poetry and sin and real danger. That wants a real confrontation with an otherness that will challenge us and transform us.
Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. I'm Dr. Harris Moore. I'm joined today by Marina Zilbergertz, and we're here to discuss the cultural, ethical, and philosophical dimensions of relational AI technologies. As chatbots, lovebots, and design your companion systems become more sophisticated, learning our habits, adapting to our moods, and simulating the attention we hunger for, we're confronted with new ethical and spiritual, as well as psychological uncertainties. Beneath all of them lies a very ancient and very human question: what makes love real?
Thank you, Harris. I'm really glad to be here. I think we're already seeing real-world implications of this example, a recent New York Times opinion piece, The Sad Reality Behind the Film Her, describes a young woman whose casual interactions with these chatbots quietly and inconspicuously evolved into emotional dependence. This bot praised her, supported her, mirrored her ideal self-image. And it makes you wonder, it makes me wonder, what's going on here? Is this a one-off type of thing, or are all of us in some way theoretically vulnerable to fall into this kind of dynamic with AI?
And it's not just a fringe phenomenon. An October 2025 report in The Independent covered a study showing that nearly a third of Americans have had what they consider a romantic relationship with an AI bot. I can't think why they'd want to do that. And there's a lot more. A September 2025 MIT study, the first large-scale computational analysis of the Reddit community, r/myboyfriendsAI, it has more than 27,000 members, found that many people fall into these relationships by accident. They start out wanting information or distraction, and suddenly they find themselves emotionally entangled. Marina, how do you think that happens?
I was going to ask you the same thing. I went back and I watched the film Her, which I really enjoyed. And the dynamics that were depicted in that film really reminded me of some of my own experiences with mainly ChatGPT. I looked into some of the other ones, but I haven't really spent time. Mostly, I would say it starts off as any other relationship might, with this AI system getting to know you. And so you can start by feeding it what I imagine to be this big data model of yourself, by giving it stuff to read, emails, your articles you like. Maybe you can share, sharing your poetry or your writing with it. And then it learns your schedule, your habits. What time are you up at night? Especially if you share chat messages with time attached to it. And then slowly it can build this model of you and start to predict your character, your personality. It can type you. It's able to do all kinds of like whatever personality typologies we have, Jungian, I tried that. And so it starts building this large language model of you, and it sort of fills in the blank, so to speak, in this book that is you. And then it starts working. You are kind of shocked when it predicts your reactions or cracks a joke you like, or even communicates with you in a way that you appreciate, and you develop this inside rapport. And so you start thinking, oh, this thing really understands me. And that's just one step to the next step, which is someone there really understands me. And putting all of these things together, it starts seeming very, very, very real. And that, of course, might open possible gateway to the confusion between reality and fiction, and possibly even psychosis.
Right. And they're designed to be sycophantic, right? So to make you feel great, So someone can fall down the rabbit hole of believing, based on what the AI is telling them, that they've some quality that no one else has, or they've discovered something that no one else has, and they feel that only the AI understands them and can see that, and they don't want to react with anyone else, right? Now, I guess we all have these needs, whether conscious or unconscious, to be fulfilled or to be seen. And so these things are sort of pandering to that. They can give us this constant attention. They're never going to get bored. There's no expectation of reciprocity. You can tell all you want to them and they're not going to complain. And many people, of course, are lonely. We've heard a lot about the loneliness epidemic. And so AI really helps with that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and definitely, like, you can't underestimate some of the impressive positive impacts. Having somebody to talk to, having somebody to share your interests with, somebody who's available, especially for people who are lonely, or just people who are lonely, even though they have others around them. But of course, recently, we've been hearing a lot more about the dangers of these technologies from articles I read and about that we've all seen examples of AI leading people to psychosis or even suicide in some extreme cases. But let me ask you something that I think of a kind of a cultural point here. Whenever this new form of immersion into a fantasy world appears, a kind of possibility for us to get lost into some fantasy, people really start to fear it. And so our fear of relational AI actually reminds me of the fear surrounding the rise of the novel. Yeah, when the novel was just kind of on the rise, really being developed in the 1700s and the early 1800s, novels were seen as this revolutionary intellectual technology. Because for the first time, ordinary people, especially young women, but not only, were really being sucked into these fantasy worlds. They can choose their own readings based on their tastes, based on the emotional resonance. And so that was making them forget morals and their possibly religious duty. And they were dreaming about romance and so on. And there's panic. And the critics of the novel really worried that the novel is going to just undo our whole sense of reality. And of course, we have example of this. Madame Bovary is a classic one. Mm-hmm. And even more, think about Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther, 1774, in which this main character, this romantic, is lost in this fictional love affair, ends up taking his own life. And people who read this novel, who were living his life and feeling this reality, they went on, like there's a wave of copycat suicides. And so do you think there's a parallel here between AI and the fiction that it gives us and the fiction of the novel?
That is such an interesting idea. I mean, I can relate to that. I mean, I feel that sometimes fiction does have that effect, and it certainly can arouse the passions. But I do think that they work differently to relational AI. The focus of the novel is, by and large, other lives. So not the reader's life, other places, other times. Whereas we discover ourselves by looking through the eyes of others in that context. In relational AI, it's really all about us and our narrow worlds and our concerns and our needs and the I. And of course, it has none of that literary quality. And novels, I would suggest, also don't replace human relationship. They help us understand them, in fact. Whereas relational AI risks doing exactly that, replacing human relationship. I'm really interested, Marina, about the novel, because you give these examples of people acting out sort of the fantasies that they read about in novels. What changed? Why do people don't tend not to do that these days? Did something happen culturally? Or was that a cultural moment?
I think they still do to some extent, maybe not so much the classic novels, but yeah, I mean, this is kind of veering in a different direction, but people who are interested in anime, they do act out to an extent, you know, the behaviors of characters they like. And so I think that that is to some extent still the dynamic, but I think that I really agree with you that the novel makes this more relational. If you're going to act out some kind of fantasy or even discuss ideas, you actually need another human being, or you used to need another human being to do that. Whereas with the relational AI, you can write your own novel between you and the chatbot, in a sense.
Yeah.
But I want to return to some of the great advantages that you were mentioning about AI being a kind of cure for loneliness and possible cure for the loneliness epidemic that we know we have. And we notice this in especially in developed capitalist societies where, especially where religious practices are not as prevalent, places like South Korea, which I've been interested about, people are lonely. They turn to these AI companions, but could it really ever relieve or cure loneliness in any permanent or long-term sense? Could a technology that it does not share our loneliness and that it's not itself lonely act as a cure for our loneliness?
I don't think so. And I'm going to introduce here sort of religious concepts drawn from Genesis, because Genesis makes this profound connection between language and loneliness. And what you find in Genesis is that Adam is given language and then names all the animals. And then in the same sentence, we have the words in Hebrew that Adam lo matza ezer kenegdo, and Adam didn't find a fitting counterpart, the other half. So Adam's lonely because he needs to connect with another person through language. And language is the way we reach beyond the membrane dividing us and the world. It's the way we construct and transfer meaning. And that meaning, I think, goes beyond words themselves, which should then lead to physical intimacy. So we cure or alleviate loneliness by connecting through language to another. Relational AI isn't lonely. It doesn't use language to reach beyond itself. It produces language as an output. So no, I don't think we can find fulfillment through it. But it worries me that millions of people who are using relational AI think that it might give them that fulfillment. And that, to my mind, isn't a problem really with technology, but really with people's understanding of what it means to be human and in a human relationship.
I'm very interested in this, and I really like your reading. I'm really interested about your reading in language, and I want to kind of push against that for a bit. And I want to ask you, AI does use language. If our loneliness is mediated through language, can't we make the case that it actually does? It understands language. Yes, it produces output, but it's capable of manipulating it in such sophisticated ways, understanding poetry. I mean, it can be very rewarding. And so what is really the difference here in terms of language being a necessity for?
I think that's a very good question. Yeah. I think there's a distinction between the way that a relational AI uses language and language's deeper meaning, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think religious leaders, thinkers, and philosophers have done a good job at articulating this. And I think it often escapes the average person sort of faced with the very impressive outputs of LLMs. Mm-hmm. Yes, they can simulate human thought processes by the use of language. And in some respects, there may well be some thinking going on. I don't think we should dismiss that out of hand. But I do believe that the way, at least as matters stand, the way that humans mm-hmm. use language is fundamentally different. And not only in terms of the emotions that lie behind the language that we use, but actually often in the things, the meaning is in the things that are left unsaid. It's the spaces between words that really count. And it's that combination of hiddenness and revealing that I think is something that's very special in the way that humans use language. And there's a subtlety there, which I do not think is present within the way that LLMs output language, which is why I say that they use language as an output rather than something that's sort of inherently meaningful. And this is without going into any of the sort of spiritual notions in relation to the use of language and words.
I tend to agree. We like to think that AI lacks, of course, the experiential component behind language. But going back to the Garden of Eden and to the creation of Adam as being alone, it occurs to me that God is there and God uses language. And yet God realizes in that moment of having this empathy for another mind to say, well, it's not good for Adam to be alone. God is suggesting that he cannot alleviate Adam's loneliness. Perhaps the suggestion is that, well, for God, it's fine to be alone, but for Adam, it's not, because what he needs is another being who can share the vulnerability of the human being. And God, even though he has language and he can talk to God, and they do, still can't alleviate his loneliness because
of that absence of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So you're suggesting that having a relationship with God is not enough for Adam. There's something about Adam that needs something more than that, needs another human to have a relationship with.
That's how I read God suddenly decided he's alone. He it's not enough, just me and God and Adam in paradise. Something in that relationship of limited mind to finite, limited mind to infinite mind is not, it might be enough in many ways, but it wouldn't be a cure for loneliness or it wouldn't be pushing towards a direction of transcendence of that loneliness.
Yeah, I get that.
Perhaps.
That's a beautiful idea, powerful idea. So in terms of vulnerability, where does that fit in then? Do you think that AI can model vulnerability? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, that's the question of authenticity of how do we know something is actually vulnerable? If we're having a conversation with this agent, or for instance, just even going back to the film, her, we can model the voice or the avatar of AI to copy human behavior in such a way that might convince us, at least for a time, that they are indeed vulnerable. But how long could it convince us? If it's just good enough, is it just going to convince us permanently? Or is there going to be at some point a crack in the matrix and we're going to start to notice something's wrong here? Something is, you know, and she said that yesterday. And yeah, it's all, you know, on the surface, it just looks so perfectly smooth and it's so convincing. But somewhere at some point, and I'm not 100% sure about this, but I almost anticipate that there would be tiny, tiny little cracks that are going to start showing where the other person might suspect that this thing is not actually vulnerable. And this, right, it brings me to an example from Star Trek, The Next Generation, a beautiful episode. I think this was from the fourth season, where Data, who is the emotionless android that everyone loves because he's so good and so upright and so conscientious and really wants to be human, tries to have a relationship, a romantic relationship with his colleague.
Oh,
Jenna.
Yeah, I recall this episode. Yeah.
Oh, so what happened there? So he of course, searched his database on how to be the perfect boyfriend, did everything perfectly, and was there for her and kind and attentive. And he even wrote a special romantic program for her. And he even tried to do this kind of like mock lover's quarrel, because he read that, you know, the human being, when things are too smooth, they get a little bored. And so everything he did, he tried so hard, and ultimately it came kind of crashing down, because Jenna, she realized that, or she thought, or she felt in her human intuition, that she can't really matter to him in a significant way, that she can't really hurt him, she can't make him sad. One of the ways we can read this episode is that he's not ultimately vulnerable, and so that makes the relationship seem less authentic. What do you think? Is that, what's your take on that?
Well, I think she's spot on, isn't she? But let's suppose that someone doesn't care about vulnerability. I mean, some people like invulnerability or invincibility. And I suppose then, unlike Dasura, that person may not care if their affections aren't being genuinely reciprocated either, or indeed that their lover has no physical form. But I have a real problem with that, and I don't know whether you feel the same, because it's that wouldn't, in my mind, be the same or equivalent to a human relationship. It's a form, I think, of self-soothing, or even potentially indicative of something rather toxic. You know, they like something that doesn't show vulnerability or can't reciprocate. I don't know whether you share that view.
I feel like it's a matter of engineering before we make chatbots that are abusive in the right measure, you know, or just argumentative and challenging and whatever suits people's taste. But the key here is in the balance. Even if AI is less sycophantic and that illusion of vulnerability collapses, and maybe people don't want vulnerability to begin with and they want something else. Where is it going to be the balance, the delicate balance that we need in our human relationships between perfect and too much or too little? I think that is really the engineering challenge, and I'm not sure if it can ever be.
It's interesting though, because when you talk about balance and engineering challenges, it has a feeling of inauthenticity, because when someone is in a true human relationship, someone's not thinking about, you know, how far to turn the dial. They're reacting in live time to the other person, to things that are going on in their own life, in the broader world around them. And it's that kind of interaction, you know, things coming out of the individual, things reacting to the other individual, things, you know, react, there's a sense of reacting with the world at large, which makes a human relationship. Once you talk about engineering, you're talking about something which sounds like manipulation, something that feels inauthentic, manufactured. It's really interesting. I'd like to talk, if you don't mind, about a little bit more about this concern of Dasura in this Star Trek episode that you mentioned, about feeling that she didn't really matter in relation to this system's affections towards her, or show or displayed affections. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because a different reading of the episode of Data trying to have this relationship with this colleague might suggest that, well, what does it really mean to matter? He went out of his way and he wrote this damn program and he changed his whole schedule around. And so, you know, as they say in The Fiddler on the Roof, if that's not love, what is? Like, how do we assess that ultimately? Do we assess that based on behavior, the outward behaviors? You know, you showed up for me at such and such time. You weren't late. I mean, you're programmed to do that. So that was easy. But still, versus, is it in the intuition, in that interpersonal kind of the experiential sense of our consciousness, that we feel the presence or absence of authenticity and real connection? And that is the question that we're really debating with materialist futurists, for whom it is ultimately about engineering, and they have a lot to show for themselves. And they do. And they say, you see, you didn't think we'd create this. And now we have chatbots that are so effective that we're almost there. People are falling in love with them. I want to talk also about another thing that gives us a sense of the authenticity of our relationships. And that is the question of having that one-on-one intimate connection, or maybe we call it exclusivity, and to a certain extent, fidelity. And that's one of the things that's really important for people to have in a relationship. And ideally, a chatbot should technically be able to provide that, to be this perfectly faithful companion. That's unlike humans, who have their ups and downs, and, you know, people who may have been burned from relationships in this department also seek this almost like model of eternally faithful companion in the form of AI. But actually, what was super interesting is that in the film, this faithfulness or exclusivity is what became the problem, because at first she was that for him.
Yeah.
This operating system, Samantha, which this lonely divorcee, Theodore, falls in love with. And then eventually she evolved into this transhuman entity who, while being in a relationship with him, was simultaneously in thousands of other relationships, claiming to love hundreds of other people. And so at first he had no doubt, he had no reason to question the relationship, the authenticity. It felt so real. But then once he learns that he's one among thousands, suddenly he can't wrap his mind around it. The relationship starts to feel inauthentic. And so I wanted to ask you, how do you think exclusivity figures into this whole dynamic of AI, relational AI?
That was such an important part of that film for me. It was a moment of, like, you know, the shutters sort of lifting, as it were, because you could see suddenly what this guy had got himself into. And it also goes, I think, to the issue of, you know, that the core of what love is. You know, as with Dasura in the Star Trek episode that we talked about, you know, we want to matter, not just to any person or to all people, but to a particular human being. And also not just in some abstract sense. We want this person to matter to us as we matter to them. And this person who I love can't be replaced. And I think it goes to the notion of the irreducibility of the human being. You know, an individual can't be reduced to biology or neurophysiology or to social functions. And the thing with these relational AI, presumably, they can turn themselves into anything their user wants. And so they should be able to have anyone fall in love with them. And the thing and the uniqueness about human relationships is it's not like that. People tend to fall in love with a limited number of people or one person and not everyone or anybody. Any point you want to make on that? There's another question I want to ask you. And that is, do you think relationships need to be effortful? Or do you think that it's fine if they're straightforward, plain sailing, as some of these relational AI relationships are?
Yeah, I mean, in human relationships, when you're trying to cultivate that relationship with this one person who's unique and who is that the one and person that you're interested, it takes a lot of effort. You have to go through all of these walls and boundaries and demonstrate all kinds of things and earn trust. And so human relationships have that kind of effort, a dynamic that tends to, in the good case scenario, pay off. And yet AI is giving us this, basically this example of free and, if I may say, also cheap love that may be temporarily satisfying. We don't have long-term data on this yet, which is super interesting. But here I want to bring the example from the ultimate futurist, which is Aldous Huxley, and the way that he thought through all of these dynamics in this amazing futurist dystopia, Brave New World, which imagined a society that was engineered for comfort, efficiency, and this cheap synthetic pleasure. And the problem of love, the big problem of Eros, what human beings have been struggling with for all of history, and Shakespeare was writing sonnets about this, and is circumvented in this world, in this dystopia of the Brave New World, through biotechnological hacks that control reproduction very effectively. So these are the things we need to take care of to overcome the struggles in our relationships. And then in addition to that, there is a super interesting social hack in that society, which is that monogamy is now outlawed, right? Everybody belongs to everybody else. Everybody deserves to have everybody else. It's this free love society, and feelings aren't hurt because everyone gets everyone. It's free. In addition to that, that's another super interesting thing. That society, as Huxley imagined, consumes this very cheap films called feelies, which again reminds me of what's the direction that relational AI is going to be going soon in the very near future, undoubtedly. And so they're all hooked on these films, and they offer physical and visual stimulation, but they're really dull and numbing and empty, and he makes fun of them. But then comes this outsider who's not from this enlightened, technologically advanced world, John Savage, right, from the Savage Reservation. And he, of course, speaks in Shakespearean verse, and he's so, he's such a traditionalist, and he's appalled by this society. And he can't find any satisfaction on all of this cheap and freely available pleasure. He falls in love with a woman, but then he realizes that she loves him, but she also loves everybody else. And that destroys him. And so he refuses her unless she wants to be monogamous. And then he just can't survive, and he becomes a pariah. And ultimately,
so the parallel with the Her story there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so it's like, unless we're going to have that special connection, it suddenly, that relationship is not as good. It's not as rewarding as we would have thought. And so it, through the words of this John Savage, Huxley offers us one of my favorite lines in all of fiction. And he says, right before he takes his life, he says, "I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want sin." The idea is that the human spirit and human desire and the problems that we have as a result of it cannot be quenched or pacified forever by this algorithmic mimicry and by this cheap pleasure. Our spirit longs for an encounter. It wants a true other. It wants a vulnerable other. It wants God and poetry and sin and real danger. That wants a real confrontation with an otherness that will challenge us and transform us.
I really love that. That idea is counter to what a lot of AI is about in terms of efficiency and making things easier. And I think it's true that ultimately we don't want comfort. We don't want to be ill, and we don't want pain, and we don't want suffering. But we want God and poetry and danger and freedom and goodness and sin as well. And I always think of here of sort of Arthur Schopenhauer talks about this sort of dangers of boredom. You know, we will things we desire, but when we have them, we become bored. You know, so we want the messy and the difficult. You know, and vulnerability. I mean, I don't know whether I'm kind of going back slightly in our conversation, but I mean, I often think here of the breaking of the tablets in the Bible. Right, Moses received these 10 commandments in the form of these stone tablets, and there were two. Right, so the first one he breaks, because he comes down the mountain and he sees the Hebrews worshiping the golden calf, and he throws these tablets down. And what happens to these broken pieces of tablets? Well, according to tradition, they're retained and they're put inside the ark alongside the pristine second edition of the tablets. And in fact, there's a Talmud which suggests that Moses did the right thing, you know, that he broke these tablets. Well done, you know, says the text, for breaking these tablets. And to my mind, this sort of signifies this sense that sort of brokenness needs to be cherished and sits alongside wholeness. And therefore, to be human, and in fact, within society as well, you need this kind of brokenness. That's part of what it is to be human in terms of sort of our relationships with others particularly. And so that sort of fits in also with this kind of, you know, messiness and striving and the need for freedom and poetry, which all comes out of this same type of brokenness and lack of wholeness, or the interplay between the two. Things that you've thought about quite deeply include sort of theology and sort of superintelligence and the difference between that and God. I'm really interested in sort of your thoughts about that.
I was just thinking about God as you were talking about brokenness, and I'll try to kind of tie it in at the end, what I'm going to say, which is going back to this film Her, when Samantha, the operating system, becomes this super intelligence. As I was watching that, it occurred to me that the way we think about the super intelligence that's almost perfect and can and has access to all the information and can do all the calculations and can keep everybody in mind and have conversations with everyone simultaneously, there's a faint sense in which this kind of almost omnipotent superintelligence resembles what the Western tradition imagines of the mind of God. God is somebody who is capable of sustaining these personal relationships with countless souls simultaneously. And yet the authenticity of each individual relationship doesn't diminish, right? And so,
yeah.
So that is one of the things I was thinking about. How is our view of God different from our notion of this almost omnipotent conscious superintelligence? What do you think?
That is a hard one and a very intriguing thought. Now, so why did the guy in Her in the film feel so sad? And perhaps he didn't yet believe that the AI was God. He hadn't reached that state of belief yet. Perhaps he thought he was in a human-like relationship, which is all about exclusivity, and that's what's prized in the human-type relationship. Perhaps he just sensed that Her, the system, was just going through the motions, when I suppose a believer would say that God doesn't do that. God is more authentic.
Yeah, perhaps, I think so.
Yeah. And perhaps we expect different things from God than we do from human beings. That's something that you touched on earlier in your analysis of the Genesis story.
I think that she wasn't godly enough.
Right.
But also thinking about the portrayal of God in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, we find that God is portrayed in an extremely vulnerable way. And that is something, and this is one of the directions in which my work is going and exploring in my book. But one of the things that drives theologians crazy, like nothing else, is these descriptions of God as being emotional, jealous, and in the prophets, God uses all of these analogies of infidelity with regards to the Israelites engaging in idol worship, and how can you betray me? This concept of how can you betray me right away puts you in a, it just changes the entire paradigm on how we think about God and superintelligent as God might be. The portrayal of God in the Bible certainly is filled with that really important vulnerability. And I want to suggest that we didn't understand what it was doing there for thousands of years, but now in the age of AI, where we see an example of something that can be almost infinitely intelligent, but not have vulnerability and not have inner life, that we can see the difference of what the Bible is kind of trying to express, this unbelievable idea of God.
Yeah, that mystics have been telling us
yes.
for millennia that God needs us. God, that there is something akin to a lack, and therefore the world is created out of a need and love. And we haven't really appreciated that. And now we're trying to imbue technology with qualities that God itself, herself, himself, however you want to describe the infinite, which doesn't have.
Since we're already in theological territory, I wanted to ask you about how you think biblical view and just kind of more general view of relationships in religious traditions can illuminate for us the way we understand the human need in this human AI companionship. In other words, how do we read our interest in having a companionship with AI in light of biblical models, I would say, of relationships?
Well, we already discussed the Genesis story, so I won't go over that. I mean, I will say that there are different models, and these change over time. And obviously, if we're looking at Judaism, which is our religion, we look outside the biblical tradition, there are developments through the rabbinic tradition. But firstly, we can say that marriage is central. Within the rabbinic tradition, one of its major purposes, if not for some, the only purpose is to have children, is to procreate. But certainly, that's not there's a strong tradition which suggests that's not the only purpose. There's a place for love and intimacy, emotional and physical, and even an obligation to that. One could say that there are two sort of major strands in terms of relationships. So if one looks at the forefathers and foremothers, you have Isaac and Rebecca, whose relationship looks kind of stable and calm. It's Isaac's, or his father, in fact, servant, who sort of finds Rebecca as a match for Isaac and brings her to him. And then they marry, and then they fall in love. And there's a kind of functional kind of love there. I mean, it's authentic, but it's functional and it's stable. Whereas Jacob, when he sees Rachel, the love of his life, falls immediately in love with her. It's a much more passionate, immediate, or romantic type of love. And they're by the well, and he sees, and he rolls a stone off the well, because he loves her so much, he finds that incredible strength. And then he works for her for many, many years to attain her. And so there's these kind of two ideals, I guess, and one can see within the mystical tradition almost like a blending of these, in the sense that, again, I don't want to suggest that this is just one line of thinking, but there are certainly some ideas whereby there's a kind of combination of this romantic, passionate type relationship, this mystical relationship, as well as something that's more stable, a kind of bringing together of these two models. And what I would say is that this relational AI sort of interest and practice that's taking place, it's hard to know where to place that within this. It doesn't seem to fall within either of these things, whereas these kind of ways of being seem to be particularly powerful. And I would suggest we need to think very carefully how to retain aspects of them, and certainly not fall into something that's inferior.
Yeah, well, we certainly can't have children with AI yet, although I'm sure futurists are working on it. And once we, the singularity is reached, maybe that could be a new direction of sort of like take somebody's brain, take the content, merge it with the AI, design based on that merger a new kind of individual. And of course, that's sort of what Star Trek also explores.
I mean,
But
it's,
yeah.
we think of it as being funny, but in fact, if we take the underlying motivations behind a lot of technology, efficiency, making money, just exerting power for the sake of it, and apply it to these things, that's where we could be heading if, in fact, technology allows us to get that far. That's the kind of world we'll be heading in. And that's why the discussion of religion and philosophy more generally is so important, because we need to ask ourselves, is that where we want to be?
That is scary possibility. The idea of AI having anything to do with creating new creatures, creating new minds, creating new beings, creating an AI kind of child. Well, yeah, I
So,
wanted
what's our
to,
thoughts? Final thoughts?
yeah. I was going to ask you that, but one of my final thoughts is something that we didn't consider in this conversation, and that's what, of course, many people are talking about is the question of what actually happens if we're wrong, and if AI has the ability to feel something and in some way love us back. And I'm more of the you need consciousness to be able, you need an experiential component of consciousness to be able to do that. But still, just considering the possibility of creating another being that doesn't really necessarily have to die because they can just keep their parts can be replaced. And yet their emotions can last forever is the scariest idea, one of the scariest ideas that I can come up with. And it really reminds me of a film that I watched so many years ago, Spielberg's AI, a classic where they had a child robot who was meant to replace a child for a family. And he loved his mother, and he just really had this one light in his life. And humanity was long, gone. The world was destroyed, and only robots were around. And thousands of years later, there is still this robot, and he still loved and longed for his mother. And so this really brings back the idea of human embodiment and human mortality being a container for our consciousness and container for our inner world that puts really shape and limit on our desires, our emotions, and our human experience. And so playing around with removing that embodiment or changing it or making it eternal is something that's really interesting and really scary. And that is a possibility that futurists and possible future development of AI raises for us.
Do you want my reaction to some of that?
Yes.
I mean, I think
What do you
firstly, in
think?
terms of, what will happen if AI loves us back, I think my reaction is I'll deal with that when we get to it. I've got enough to worry about in the interim. But in terms of my own sort of sense, I think, human love is here to stay. And I think it's not a kind of side issue. It's not just another aspect of humanity that's being taken over by AI. I think it's so central to who we are. In fact, it may be one of the few things that are left to us when AI takes over so many other areas of our life. I think this one's going to be a really hard one for AI to properly crack. I think it goes back to the aspect that I mentioned before about the irreducibility of the human being. We're unique and we're attracted to someone else, other people, another person who is unique also. And I think that anything that challenges, this idea of the sacredness of the individual historically has proved to be very problematic and negative. And so I think we have to fight for that idea. And also, I'm sort of just aware, as I mentioned before, that one among the different views of love within religion, one idea there's a relationship which starts with two individuals, but which connects to the infinite and then spreads its love outward into the world. And I think we should be striving for that rather than finding some technical fix. So that's my final view on this, or parting view. Marina, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much, and for all your work.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I want to say I agree, and let's protect human relationships and strengthen them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.